Welcome everyone to Commerce Experience. I'm your host, Brian Walker, Chief Strategy Officer at Bloomreach. Today I'm joined by Michael Harvey, Chief Technology Officer at Quora. Quora supports international brands, retailers, and B2B clients with e-commerce technology solutions, and Michael's responsible for Quora's global technology organization, spanning software engineering, solutions architecture, DevOps, and technical support. Michael brings a tremendous amount of experience and context to the conversation we're having today. Having worked in digital and e-commerce, writing and architecting solutions for customers for decades. And now Michael brings a particular focus to the headless commerce, composable commerce space, driving the firm's leadership position in this rapidly evolving field. Enjoy the show. Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Really looking forward to the conversation. It's great to see you again. I hope we get to see each other in person before too long again.
No kidding. I'm surprised we didn't run into each other in Vegas when we were both there for far too long.
We won't go there.
Yeah. Before we jump into the questions, I just have to say, you probably have the coolest office of any guest I've had on the podcast before. And I know those of you who are listening via audio only are not going to be able to appreciate it. But Michael, just give us a little bit of a quick little tour there. It's pretty cool.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, in my other life, I'm a recording musician and a producer. And I've been doing that for, I think I started writing songs when I was 15 after discovering the Beatles. So anyway, I've got a Gibson Lucille, which is a semi-hollow body guitar like B.B. King used to play. I've got some multicolored acoustic panels in the background that help me with the audio. I've got a little mixing desk off to my left and a poster of James Dean.
Yeah, which it takes a lot of confidence to hang a poster of James Dean in your office. I'm just going to say.
Thank you. And it's all real. It's all real.
Well, Michael, we always lead off an interview on the podcast with the same question. What was your first job or role that dealt with e-commerce or digital?
Okay. So if we go with digital and just say software real fast, I would actually jump way back. So I made the move from investment banking into software back in the late 80s.
Yeah.
I went to this little tiny company nobody had ever heard of at the time called Microsoft. My wife and I just wanted to relocate to Seattle, and I knew I didn't want to work at Boeing. And so I was a product manager there for a while. That's kind of where I got into software. And then after that, I was doing some consulting for some of the early dot-com internet companies in Seattle. So Amazon was literally just a gleam in Jeff Bezos's eye at this point. But if you look back, a lot of that was figuring out how are we going to make money on this thing called the web, mm-hmm. you know, that was new. So this would be like digital images from Corbis, you know, Bill Gates's other company, or streaming music from real networks using their compression technology and things like that. But in terms of what we'd think of as modern e-commerce, for me, that really was when I joined my current company, Quora, back in 2009. And we had just done our very first Magento project at that time. And we were sort of this jack of all trades, open source systems integrator. We worked with ERP and CRM and BI and all those things. And Magento at the time was just sort of another one of these interesting open source technologies. But it really caught fire. We caught fire with it. We really committed to just being one of Magento's biggest partners as quickly as we could. And that really set us on this path. So initially as a very technology-focused SI, and then increasingly adding the things like design, UX, visual that we win awards for now, strategy around SEO and content and things like that, and are really now this full-service agency. And we're going to obviously, I think, talk a lot about headless and composable commerce, and that's really opened the field to us now in terms of the vendors that we're working with, including Bloomreach. So.
Yeah, I feel like you and I have had kind of this interesting kind of parallel career, mm-hmm. you know, with all the different stops in our background and you having spent time in Seattle.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. speaking of composability, that's actually where I kind of wanted to start.
Okay.
And to talk about composability in commerce and experience technology. But before we get into the meat of the topic, I think it's important that maybe you share a definition of what composability is and kind of help illuminate the concept for those who are listening who may not be that familiar with it. And maybe to add, you know, how is it related to and different than the concept of headless?
Yeah. Okay. Those are great questions and very near and dear to my heart. So like you, I do a lot of public speaking at events and things. And so this is really the topic that I talk about most right now. And so I think you said the right, you had some keywords in there. So headless being one, composability being another one. And these are just like responsive design was, say, you know, 10 years ago or Web 2.0 or things like that. It's tempting to sort of put these into the category of just, you know, the buzzwords du jour. But basically, we're seeing a pretty fundamental shift in how computing is done. So the history, if you look at the history of computing, really since the dawn, everything was done via what we would now call monolithic applications. And what that means in its most simplest is the front end and the back end, they're the same application. So the thing that an end user is interacting with is being delivered, served, managed, everything by the same thing that's doing whatever business logic is being executed by the system. So that would be a monolithic system. And it doesn't matter what kind of the flavor of it is. So, you know, we can think about mainframes and minis. We can think about client server computing. We can think about the early dumb web. We can think about SaaS. All of these traditionally have been served up as monolithic applications. So you can think of it as a single black box. So the very first undoing of that would be where you decouple the head, and you'll hear it called head, front end, UI, presentation layer, all of those are the same thing. You decouple the head from the back end. And so you've now created a headless back end. A lot of people will mistakenly say, oh, it's a headless front end. And that makes no sense because front end is the head. So you now have a headless back end. And what's interesting is I think headless is actually a misnomer because it, really what you have is a back end that could have multi heads, right? Yes. You've now created that possibility. We can talk about that more. So at this point, you've now kind of created two black boxes, if you will. You've decoupled the front end from the back end, the head from the back end, and you allow them, you permit them only to communicate via application programming interfaces, APIs. So they only communicate programmatically. And what is important about that is it means that neither system has to know anything about how the other system does what it does. And there's right off the bat, there's a bunch of benefits that you can get from this. So you now have two different applications, so you can scale them independently. You can host them separately and independently. You can make deployments to the front end without disrupting the back end. You can innovate on the user experience, et cetera. So that would be sort of the first journey. That would be decoupling.
And those themselves can also, in a sense, be monolithic applications. We were doing that at Hybris, for example, with CMS systems on as the head with commerce, business logic and capability served from an application like Hybris, for example, which is, I think, just still an important concept for people to keep in their head.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a really important insight. And that's kind of why I said you now have two black boxes. So, so you know, you still maybe haven't solved some of the more fundamental challenges, but you've at least started down that path. But yes, you're absolutely correct. That backend can still be, you can still have what we would call a virtual monolith, right? Yes. Where the backend and the front end are still coupled, but just programmatically now.
Yes.
Yeah. So that would be kind of our first step. And then I already sort of alluded to what I would call actual headless is where you have a single backend architecture or tech stack that can now serve multiple heads. And that might be, for example, web and you know, mobile desktop. So we're talking about a progressive web app probably, but it could be a smart speaker. It could be, you know, a clienteling app.
An appliance.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So at that point, I would say you're now headless. And then to get to composable, you use that word. This is kind of the, if we're going sort of white belt, yellow belt, green belt, you know, we're now getting into, we're now getting into like brown belt territory here. And so composability is where you actually can start to decompose the back end into sets of somewhat autonomous services, or what we would tend to call microservices now. And the power of this is that I can now start to select the best of breed solutions for the different types of tasks that I have. And those could be, for example, things like what's in the Bloomreach stack. So CMS, marketing and engagement, search. I can start to think about PIM, OMS. All of these things can start to be sort of communicating programmatically in that same way and composed into a solution. And obviously core commerce. So what are we talking about there? We're talking about cart and checkout and catalog and things like that. And so you're now composing a solution out of all of these best of breed point solutions. And then there's even, it's more of a term of art in Europe right now. There's an acronym MACH, microservices, API first, SaaS, cloud native, you know, that hasn't caught on in the US yet. Perhaps it will, but it gets at that sort of black belt concept, if you will.
So. Right. Taking composability kind of to the edge, so to speak, and how you architect a solution. Really great breakdown there. I completely agree. For businesses that are kind of thinking about moving in this direction, how do you kind of approach the conversation about, you know, what I would say, evolution versus revolution, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a way in which you can think about your existing commerce and experience tech stack and think about evolving that. You know, you sort of broke that down in terms of like headless, for example, and even kind of breaking it down and starting to make that a more composable architecture without necessarily having to address everything all at once. Yeah. And then, of course, there's replatforming, right? Taking the step to really move your entire business, your business logic, how you're serving customers through digital channels, kind of all at once. How do you approach that question when you're engaging with a client mm-hmm. and they're thinking about taking in a very intentional step forward? But how should they think about that and make sure that it's the right decision and kind of the right path for them?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to unpack there because you had concepts in there that impinge on the tech stack. You also had the idea of your business, right? And we can talk about sort of composability when it comes to, you know, business itself. In your previous life at Forrester, what are your mm-hmm. competitors there? Gartner, they love this term, PBCs, package business capability.
I always thought it sounded like PCBs. And so I was just, yeah.
I don't know if it's going to catch on, frankly, but the concept is a good one. And so, you know, it's not just about technology here.
Yes.
But I think one of the most important points here, I'll make a couple points. One is we're still early days in this. This is a fundamental shift that's going to be playing out in the same way that other compute paradigms have played out. It's going to be playing out for years still. So for those of you who are listening, who are merchants who have not started down this journey yet, you don't have to panic. But that said, you need to understand this terrain and have a plan and a viewpoint and a strategy for how you're going to be moving down this path. And you correctly said it's an evolution and not a revolution. And so the reason why that's important is that the traditional sort of heavy forklift rip and replace type of upgrade that have been so painful and have been why you only see that type of cycle every 10, 15 years, right? It's just too painful to do it. That's a paradigm that can move into the past now. So even if a company, even if you are on a monolithic kind of legacy or even homegrown type of tech stack with a lot of tech debt, you can start down this path because the very nature of a composable approach allows for this, what we would call incremental innovation. The more violent term would be a strangler pattern or a strangle strategy. And so I'll give you an example. It could be the case that for many merchants, that what they're seeing is conversion rate issues in cart and checkout. And they may just be hamstrung by kind of an old-fashioned UX that's very difficult to change, or it might just be slow and they're kind of running up against the limits of whatever the platform has. So start there. And there are now microservices out there that are very optimized around cart and checkout, for example. But the place that I think makes the most sense for most people to start, where I think most people should start, is with that front end and getting that decoupling happening. And the reason is I sort of alluded to it earlier. There's benefits to start reaping right away from doing that relate to optimizing the user experience. It's going to be a progressive web app at this point, a PWA that you should be building. So it's going to be faster. It's going to score better on core web vitals. SEO equity is going to be better. All of those kinds of things can be realized quickly. And then what's great about this is you're now able to focus very much around an ROI kind of conversation with your executives, with your board, instead of technology now just being a cost center, right? Which has always been, hire the army of Accenture consultants, come in, pray for 2 years that when you power on the beast, it's going to work, right? That's the old paradigm. Well, imagine you can take a couple months, pivot your cart and checkout experience, show the conversion rate increase, which drops right to the bottom line, and then go back and do it, you know, repeat. So,
yeah, the cost of testing and innovation on an old sort of legacy monolithic application is very high, and it often will get in the way of fundamental performance improvements and in usability and so on that is really a shame, because you have to put it in a queue. It has to obviously be developed. It has to be tested. It has to be rolled out. And obviously, the larger the business, the more risk is inherent in each software release.
That's right.
Each upgrade, each update. And so decomposing those things, you know, separating the concerns between the front end and the back end, as you said, there's a likely to be immediate performance improvements on the user experience, how fast your site experience feels to the customer, but also the agility and flexibility, and then the ability to bring in, you know, other solutions to support the user experience, right, be it search, et cetera. Now, I think a lot of customers probably don't realize that there are a lot of people listening who are merchants and marketers probably don't realize that they already in a way probably are operating at some level a composable architecture, because they probably have a lot of different point solutions already plugging into their experience. But if they're plugging it into a kind of a monolithic architecture, they're still going to be limited in terms of what advantages that they can gain. So I completely agree with your perspective there.
You're pointing at something really important there, and I think it would be worth actually calling out. And I kind of glossed over it when I was giving the, you know, how we move from monolithic to composability. There's another really key layer in there and key concept, which is orchestration. And it's no mystery that these terms are musical, right? Composing, orchestration. So what you just described is where the complexity lies in all of this. So now you've got all these point solutions. So historically, in the scenario like what you're describing, I may have all these different pieces, but the way that they're integrated together is probably, you know, via direct kinds of integrations. And so taking the example of commerce, you know, I may have my order management system and my ERP directly integrated to commerce, right? Whereas in a composable world, you want that integration to actually happen up a level. You want my commerce, my PIM, my CMS, my, you know, all those different components being orchestrated at a level up. And that's, again, something just here at Cora, that's something that we've invested a lot of time and our own effort into figuring out how to do that, because that is the challenge there. But once you sort of get that working, once you get that architecture in place, you then are able to address one of the challenges you just raised, which is in a legacy monolith, I change one thing, I have no idea what the potential repercussions are, which is why we have to go through what you just said. I have to do all this regression testing. I have to, you know, turn on the new capability slowly. I have to wait for IT to get to it and things like that.
Segregate servers and all kinds of stuff that goes
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Yeah. So, whereas now, if I want to change my, you know, my tax or payments or something like that, I'm now just dealing, the QA problem has become much smaller because I'm just now literally testing that without risking breaking other parts of the system.
Exactly right. For a business person who's typically going to want to ensure that their, you know, their business objectives are being met, that there is a great ROI case associated with these kinds of evolutions, and wants to be smart enough to have a conversation with the software community, with their own developers, their own CIO and partners, you know, what would you have them focus on? What do you think is the most important thing for a business leader to focus on as they think about these concepts?
So you're saying other than listening and watching this podcast?
Well, that's a start. Yeah.
No, it's a start. Hopefully a good start. No, seriously. I mean, just some casual web searching is going to lead to more content than you can possibly consume ever in a lifetime. We'll probably touch on it in a little bit, but I mean, typing into ChatGPT, you know, seriously, you know, what are the benefits of a composable solution versus a monolithic, you know, you'll get college level essays.
You'll get a synthesis of many different people's points of view. Coming back at you, and hopefully it'll be relatively easy to digest versus like 50 links. Yeah.
Well, exactly. I've done it to see what it says, and it's actually, you know, pretty good. Get some, if you phrase your question well, some pretty cogent responses. But no, in all seriousness, there is a lot of just information to be gleaned out there. And I think it's more the case where there's too much, and you very quickly can get into a sense of overwhelm rather than, and so sort of my thought would be to try to be selective and try to probably identify, you know, one or two voices or viewpoints there that you know resonate, that you can kind of see. And also I'm thinking now of a vendor like a Bloomreach, mm-hmm. or a solution provider like a Quora, engaging with us. And the dynamic between the SI and the vendors now, it's very interesting, because in a composable world, you're now by definition almost certainly going to be multi vendor. And so having a partner, having a solution provider who is able to help handhold a little bit through that, I think is an important thing as well. I think my overall would be focus on where the lowest hanging fruit is. What are the pain points that you have in your business? And then what are ways that I might just start to address those very specifically? And again, part of the beauty here is that you don't have to do it all at once, which means you also don't have to learn it all at once.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the value of the partner in this new sort of era has changed and shifted, right? And it becomes much more advisory. Many partners are building sort of reference architectures. You talked about your focus on orchestration. When you have a set of solutions that you're very familiar with, you're very familiar in combining within experiences, especially with specific commerce platforms and sort of the big building blocks, such as content and product discovery and customer data, and obviously payments and optimization and these kind of domains. When you have experience bringing those together, there's a lot of value there. A, in not making all the same mistakes that people may have made before, and having confidence in the architecture and approach, and then being able to apply a roadmap. Again, it doesn't all have to happen at once, but having a logical sequence and roadmap that can actually, you know, drive some success. Michael, if you could kind of double click on the concept of orchestration, especially in a composable kind of headless setting, you know, even myself who works very closely with this, sometimes I'm not confident in my own sort of concept of how is that playing out inside, you know, a commerce experience. You know, what is orchestration? And what are some of the things that a partner such as yourself is really focusing on to make sure these solutions are all working harmoniously, they're integrated effectively, and that the customer experience is as desired? What are some of the things to really focus on there? And what are we really talking about?
It's hard not to get these musical terms in there, isn't it? Hopefully we're harmonizing well here. So I think that orchestration is sort of it's the thing that people want to sort of divert attention from, yeah. right? It's all yeah. composability. It's wonderful. But clearly there is complexity here. We're talking about technology.
Lots of different APIs that need to come together. Right.
Exactly. Multiple vendors, things like that. So there's a couple important points here. One is the industry has coalesced around certain standards for doing this. So, and by and large, they are open source. So there are going to be things like React, which is a JavaScript mm-hmm. library for the front end. Next, which is a framework for React that allows it React to run on the server. So you get tons of benefits from that. Node, another JavaScript library framework for how you kind of create these backend services and things like that. So one important point around orchestration is to make sure that you're working within these kinds of this best tech stack. There really is kind of that out there. On the API side, it's either going to be REST, which is fine, or GraphQL. You know, it's got to be one of those things for really a modern experience. So there's two components to orchestration. There's what we can call the backend for front end, and then there's the service layer. And the backend for front end, or BFF, what it does is it allows that decoupled head in a headless system to be platform agnostic and unopinionated as to what's lower down in the stack. And so what that means is that the front end just only needs to know one language. Let's say it knows how to speak English. This backend for front end then handles the translation. It handles the API routing, all of those kinds of things. So I've now isolated the front end from whatever is in the backend. Now you could try to have that backend for front end also then manage how the services below it are orchestrated, but you're now starting to create potentially some brittleness in the system. And so this is where you get into a concept that would be called integration hubs, for example. And there's some commercial products out there that do this, or you can actually do this using some of the cloud services from the hyperscalers, like Amazon has. Yep. EventBridge and things like that allow you to set up message queues and things like that. So again, you want the integrations to happen at sort of the same tier and really be co-equal. And then they expose themselves to the backend for front end, which handles all of the translation and the routing and getting things to the right places. And then the front end or front ends, right? Because again, we're in this multi-headed environment, can be unopinionated and undisturbed by whatever's going on in the backend. Now, all of that said, I just, you know, gave you a mouthful there. That's still, there's a lot of thought that has to go into that. And so I would say it's important to, as you're going through this journey, A, be working with a trusted advisor. And that could be a company like a Quora. It could be an SI, it could be an agency, it could be a consultant, and also work with vendors such as Bloomreach or Commerce Tools, or Adobe is moving down this path as well, where they understand this and where they get it and where they're moving in that direction. So I think there's no like magic orchestrator out there. It's a core part of the exercise of the composable journey.
Yeah, it takes configuration and knowledge and best practices to do it effectively. Absolutely. One of the things that I know you're particularly passionate about is, you know, the complexities around managing the product catalog and inventory management, and the fact that that's often kind of overlooked, you know, when businesses are really thinking about scaling and you know, diversifying their business and so forth. I'd love to hear you talk more about that.
Mm-hmm. So I use those as sort of a proxy for business complexity generally. So if you think about a merchant, let's take an example. We work with a lot of these types of clients, for example. They're multi-brand, multi-currency, multilingual, multinational type of company. They may be growing through acquisitions where they're acquiring new brands. And you can imagine, I may acquire an up and running business and I look at their tech stack and this one's on Hybris and that one's on Salesforce and, you know, that one's on Adobe, et cetera. And you've now got this challenge of how do I start to kind of consolidate and rationalize that technology? And one of the benefits of a composable approach, like we've been talking about, is I could start with something like, I'm going to create this agnostic front end, this agnostic head and a back end for front end for it that now can help orchestrate all these different pieces. And now I'm going to start to think about, okay, how do I start to over time kind of move and consolidate services like that? So you can imagine that type of challenge or that type of... So in that kind of scenario, you could have a use case like this, where I'm the women's clothing line merchandiser in Amsterdam for EMEA, let's say. And I'm talking about an employee now, right? I need to be able to see the parts of the catalog and inventory levels for the things that I have rights to. I need to be able to set what elements of that this person can control. Can they control pricing and things like that? And so you can imagine it's tempting to focus a lot on the benefits to the end customer experience, but it's also really important to think about the benefits that or not, if you do it poorly, that you're gifting to your internal stakeholders as well. And that's where you get back to kind of that packaged business capability or that composable business concept where I can't just make my tech stack composable. I also have to think through.
Yeah. How are you going to run the business?
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the things that becomes very interesting is as software people, we're very used to thinking in terms of requirements, right? And what do the platforms do and what's native and what's out of the box and things like that. And what you have to recognize here is that really you need to start thinking about things like price. What does price mean? Well, price means different things to different people. It means one thing and it has to expose itself in a particular way to finance. It has to expose itself, be interacted with in a different way by that merchandiser that I just described and so forth. So you almost have to start with, you know, something like price or promotions and then ramify from that into, okay, how do I now manifest that to my different business users and where does that play in the different components of my technology?
Couldn't agree more. I think, you know, as a software vendor who serves composable capabilities out there, you know, we focus on the business users who are going to be interacting with those parts of the business process and customer experience. So take just product discovery, for example, and what does a merchandiser want to do to manage categories and drive merchandising, you know, goals and objectives that they have, as well as just, you know, core search and how do we personalize and at the same time drive segmentation and all these things. Yep. And we're very focused on that as a business, right?
Yep. That's a great example.
And what separates vendors who are focused on specific capabilities from, let's say, the monolith or even open source technology that can kind of do the core basics of something like search, for example, but are not going to support maybe, you know, machine learning based optimizations, but also the business users. And I think it's really an important thing. It can also drive some complexity into the organization and the business processes that you're using to run the business. If you're going this direction, will change, right? And sometimes you've built an organization with skills and people who are, you know, tuned to the environment you operate in today. Let's say it's a monolith, a commerce application, for example. And obviously the roles and the skills and other things may change, and you may be interacting with more than one solution, right? To accomplish what used to, you could only really accomplish in one solution, right?
Right.
So those are things to also think about when you're talking about running the business. Yeah. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is something you need to be really thoughtful about when you're making these kinds of decisions.
Yeah, I think the trade-off, and you were sort of alluding to it in there, which is that a traditional monolith has to be all things to all people, yeah, and therefore it's unlikely to be the best thing at any one thing for anybody. And so you have everybody kind of going, oh, well, it's good enough, and it's what I'm used to, and it's what I've built my business around. And there's now an opportunity. I would argue there's an imperative to go back and rethink that, because if you're not, for sure, your competitors are. And that kind of going all the way back to the start of the conversation, yeah, don't panic if you're not there now, but have your plan and your roadmap for how you're moving in this direction, for sure.
Yeah. And I feel like we're on the cusp of yet another pretty significant possible evolution in user experience and obviously business process and other things. And that's going to lead me into maybe my next question, which is around generative AI, which again is very nascent, it's very new, very immature in some ways, but already transforming a lot of things. Yeah. And, you know, we can look at generative AI. I've been writing about this a lot on my newsletter and see lots of different ways it could potentially impact how customers expect to interact, as well as how the business operates, right? And if you don't have an architecture and a technology sort of stack that enables you to be agile with exploring these things, doesn't mean you have to be on the bleeding edge, but you don't want to be so far behind that you can't keep up, right? And you can't innovate alongside your competitors or potentially someone coming in asymmetrically in your industry and disrupting. And, you know, that's just another example, just like the iPhone, right? Revolutionized how we thought about user experience pretty quickly and took what seemed like kind of a silly, touch point, so to speak, and made it critical, right? In a matter of a couple of years. And there were a lot of people who were kind of caught behind and had to make some very pragmatic decisions that they had to unwind later, and get out from behind. But how are you seeing generative AI playing out in the conversations you're having with clients? What kinds of questions are they asking? And how do you think businesses should be thinking about that today?
So in terms of what the nature of the questions are, they tend to be fairly high level, and they tend to be more phrased along the lines of, you know, how should I be using this? You know, is it going to become a thing? And so I want to actually address that. But you also said a couple other interesting things in there around, for example, as a business, we all know that there's just data coming from all these different sources, right? From my social channels, from my .com site, from my stores, from all these different places. And I should be doing something with it. And everybody pretends that this is like a really easy challenge. Oh, you got all this data. Now you can make smart decisions.
Just put it in a data warehouse and you're done, right?
Yeah, done. So that's one area where you already can start to see the whole premise of generative AI is, you know, these models, obviously, that are being built. And so there's going to be applications, and already are, where these models can be used to run against proprietary data sets or marry your proprietary data set with third-party data and things like that.
And even if you don't have a lot of data, now you can synthesize data and create more data that you can then create models around. Yeah.
Exactly. So definitely making sense of data, but that still requires you to then have the perspective or the viewpoint of what is it that I'm actually trying to extract from my data. And so that then leads, I think, to the most obvious applications, which would be things like segmentation, personalization, dynamic content, and things like that. You can imagine scenarios where somebody is searching for something, and instead of, you know, a human being having to write reams and reams of copy or product descriptions, why not let those things be generated in real time on the spot in response to, you know, cues that you're getting from the customer, let's say. So I think those are some of the obvious ones, but I would love to speculate wildly here if that's okay.
Please do.
So I gave a talk, I don't know, probably 10 years ago at some conference where I was talking about how 3D printing was going to revolutionize the fashion industry. Yeah. And, you know, one of the scenarios I trotted out was, you could imagine being a business traveler and I show up in my hotel room and based on the weather or whatever, you know, I dial something up and it spits out this thing. I wear it. I put it back in the recycling. I've got this perfect virtuous loop and all of that. But for lack of a better term, and I just kind of made this up prior to our call, I was thinking about what if you had the concept of endless inventory? And you can start to think about with sort of the advances in additive manufacturing, right? 3D printing, robotics and things like that. But then also couple that with generative AI, you could imagine instead of trying to personalize and guide someone to a product that I already have sitting in my warehouse and personalizing it that way. Well, what if I could figure out what this person actually really wants and is looking for, you know, shoes of a particular color and size and function, whatever. And you could imagine now, you know, co-designing something with a customer in real time, and then it's being manufactured in the background. We already have logistics to get it to you in near real time. So, you know, I think there are some fun, you know, more speculative kind of scenarios where this is going to come into play for sure.
Yeah, I've been writing a lot about this, as I mentioned, and I think there's a lot of ways this technology has the potential to transform the demand chain and the supply chain. Yep. And how we think about engaging customers and ultimately producing, designing product.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it is very early, right, in this journey. I think starting kind of simply, I think trying to understand it, and yes, there's some guardrails you should probably put on your organization as well, because there are some concerns and considerations around intellectual property and trademarks and these kinds of things to be cognizant of. But it's certainly pretty interesting. So that was an interesting question to ask you before my last question on the podcast. And we always ask the guests the same last question. And you can go back to what we were just talking about if you like, or you can kind of focus on something else. But the last question we always ask every guest, you ready?
Okay, I'm holding on to my seat.
What futuristic digital commerce innovation are you most looking forward to, you know, becoming a reality? Or alternatively, what innovation do you think is just overhyped and you think is just kind of a ridiculous waste of time to think about, you're tired of reading articles about, and you think we should just stop talking about it? So you can kind of go high, you can go low, or you can go both ways.
Can I do both?
Yeah,
okay, so I'll go both and there could be some crossover. So I've been very bullish and interested in autonomous vehicles for a long time. My oldest daughter who went to Stanford did a thesis on the ethics of self-driving cars. And so I've been a promoter of this since then. And at some point, you imagine we're being driven around in our cars. Well, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to do the same things we do in other settings. We're going to socialize, we're going to watch movies, and we're going to shop for things. So I think the autonomous vehicle of the future becomes another kind of head, if you will, to these headless backends that we're talking about. The thing that I would have to say, and it's almost like a low blow, it's almost too easy, is I won't even go with the metaverse. That's too low. I think I would say crypto, but I want to be a little nuanced here, because I think part of the problem around crypto is that people pretend it's all one thing. And in fact, it's a very, you know, diverse terrain. And so we have clients coming to us asking what they should be doing with NFTs. And I'm kind of like, well, probably not much right now. Now, you can imagine scenarios where, I can sell an NFT that allows someone to wear a particular sneaker in the metaverse and for that physical item. And it's a one-off to show up on the doorstep. You can tell stories like that. I'm not sure how big that is, honestly. But you can imagine NFTs as a totally secure way of transmitting to someone a product warranty and then updating the benefits that you get with that warranty over time in a way that is you know, simple, secure.
What if I sell the product before the warranty is expired? Why shouldn't I just very easily transfer the warranty.
Exactly. Proof of purchase, yeah. Chain of custody, provenance, all those kinds of things. And there are going to be applications, like I can think of things in the insurance world or the reinsurance world, where we're having a blockchain driven, unbreakable kind of ledger, that chain of custody that we're talking about, or what commitments were made and things like that, I think could be very powerful. But in terms of, like, we're all going to be, Venmoing each other Bitcoin and things like that and using that to purchase, I think the governments are working on the fiat currency equivalents of crypto. I think we're going to be, most people are probably preferentially going to be using that. I don't think we're going to be creating digital wallets and, So anyway, I could be completely wrong, just like I was with 3D printing for garments. But
you were just early on the 3D printing thing, Michael. I think the jury's still out.
But yeah, my bet for things that are hyped right now that are going to take a little bit longer to sort out than everybody would like would be sort of that crypto, Web3, blockchain, boom, invest in it. I think we're coming out of that phase, and reality is starting to set in a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, wonderful. Thank you for all that. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. I really enjoyed the conversation. Love getting your thoughts and insights.
Likewise.
And for the listeners out there, thank you so much for listening to this episode. You can check out the show notes for links to where you can connect with Michael and, of course, Cora. My information, of course, is there as well. And I'd love for you to reach out, and I'd love to hear your feedback and ideas for the show as we move things down the tracks, move things forward. Meanwhile, be safe, be well. Here's to good business.